Lunar Science. Welcome to Lunar Science, the series in which we discuss the scientific investigation of the Moon and its environment in the Artemis era. When you first hear the term space weather, your first reaction might be that this is a nonsensical term. After all, there's no air in space, so there could be no clouds, no rain, no anything. However, as we shall hear in episode 25, there is such a thing as space weather. We will allow Harlan Spence to explain. Harlan is the director of the Institute for Study of Earth, Oceans and Space at the University of New Hampshire. He is also principal investigator for the Cosmic Ray Telescope on the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which has been circling the Moon since 2009.
So, good afternoon, everyone, and thanks to the organizers for the opportunity to talk to you today on the topic of space weather. And Heidi actually queued me up. There was no, malice aforethought here. And I wanted to start this by saying, if you remember only one notion from my talk, then let me motivate that idea with a quote from somebody you probably won't recognize, Charles Dudley Warner. This is a quote often attributed to Mark Twain. And so it was Warner who once opined, "The weather in New England is a matter about which a great deal is said and very little done." And so in this presentation, my aim is to convince you that when it comes to space weather, there is a similar degree of discussion, but lots is being done about it. And furthermore, lots of science is being done because of it. So with that, let me dive into our discussion and just point out that a lot of this is really informed by my experience as a PI on the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. So really a shout out to the LRO team, a shout out to my team as well, who really contributed much to that. So what is space weather? It's variability in the environment, space environment, that causes disruption to technological aspects of our society. Some of it's on space, some of it's on Earth. In the context of the Moon, though, the space weather I'd like to focus on at the Moon really is, I think, you can focus on different aspects, but I think the more important ones have to do with the solar wind plasma and also energetic charged particles in the form of solar energetic particles and galactic cosmic rays. The solar wind, which does reach the Moon's surface, does so in a very interesting way. It contributes to surface charging. It contributes to the sort of global electric circuit in the near surface environment. And therefore, it has a huge impact on the dust environment. The other two forms, and that's what I'm going to focus on mostly in this talk. The first are these episodic events triggered by an eruption on the Sun that accelerates ambient particles in the corona and in transit from the corona to throughout the solar system to very, very high energies. These particles have enough energy that they require a fair amount of mass to stop them, and so they penetrate rather deep centimeters into the regolith. And because of the characteristics of that, they can actually lead to deep dielectric charging when the incident rate exceeds the dielectric breakdown constant and the discharge time. These solar energetic particles, the SEPs, can contribute to ionizing radiation dose. They're infrequent, they're intense, they're low energy, so you mostly can shield against them. And so we need good space weather prediction to be able to know when to do an EVA and when to take shelter. Galactic cosmic rays are a whole nother beast in themselves. These are extremely energetic, coming from deaths of supernova, some of the most exotic explosive events in our universe. They arrive and travel through our solar system, and they can penetrate very deep, meters even, into the regolith. And they're of a sort that produces very damaging ionizing radiation in terms of biological effects. So we've got these three populations. They're all important for space weather. And they also are opportunities for doing science. My focus today is going to be on the solar particles and galactic cosmic rays, just in the spirit of time. Pick your poison. When do you worry about these? And really, there's nowhere to run and no time to hide. At the times when the galactic cosmic rays are at a minimum, that is at solar maximum. And at solar maximum, that's when solar proton events are most likely. So all things being considered, you know, solar protons are more easily shielded against. And so you could argue that you would prefer to maybe be up during solar maximum when galactic cosmic rays are a minimum. I always like to talk about the Wargo axiom, as I call it. I think many of you probably remember Mike Wargo, who was instrumental in some of the early return to the moon discussions. And he was always quick to point out that science enables exploration and exploration enables science. And I think all of the instruments on LRO were very much motivated by a design driven by human exploration, but all of them were also nimble enough for conducting innovative science. And that's certainly the case of the Cosmic Ray Telescope for the Effects of Radiation that we developed. What are the kinds of things that I'm talking about? So you could say lunar science enabled by space weather. What's really going on there? Well, take a galactic cosmic ray and now hit it into the lunar regolith. As it loses energy and buries itself into the regolith, it produces secondary radiation in the form of protons, neutrons, gamma rays, electrons, so forth. The whole zoology of the cascade of high energy nuclear physics. So the part that escapes then becomes a way to look at the underlying regions and the properties of that energy that escapes in the form of particles or photons tells you something about that material. And so we've already heard about sort of the neutron gamma lunar imaging. That gives you some sense of the hydration of the subsurface. What it also does, not only is it a new sort of way of looking at the moon through these secondary albedo particles, it also is a source of secondary radiation, and sometimes that secondary radiation contributes in bad ways. And so you can look at the primaries versus what we call the albedo coming off. It's not literally photons, it's mostly in the form of charged and neutral particles that contribute to the dose. And so it's a rich interplay between science you can do and the physics of the interaction and the interaction with humans and robots.
Harlan Spence. Just as terrestrial weather forecasts could be improved with better data and advanced computer modeling, there is room to improve space weather forecasting. In February of 2022, Leon Golub offered his ideas on how to do this. Before he does so, I need to explain some terminology. The corona is a region of tenuous but very hot plasma around the sun. It is, indeed, hotter than the visible surface of the sun, that is, the photosphere. A coronal mass ejection is when the sun belches out millions of tons of mainly hydrogen into interplanetary space. EUV is extreme ultraviolet light, which in energy lies between ordinary ultraviolet and X-rays.
I'm going to talk about what we consider will be a way of improving space weather forecasts. And the bottom line is we won't know how much improvement you get until you try it. So I'm going to argue for trying it. The topic is the middle corona. The middle corona is, and it's really a not very well observed region. There's a big gap there between the inner corona, where we've developed instruments to see that very well, the outer corona, which has been observed for many, many years and is the basis of forecasts to a large extent. The middle corona, there's actually a very large team of people right now working on defining what we mean by the middle corona. It's basically a region of transitions, transition from low beta back to high. Of course, the chromosphere corona transition region goes the other way. It's a region where the corona transitions from collisional to radiative excitation, where it transitions from being dominated by closed magnetic structures to predominantly open structures. I will say it's a little bit like the way Justice Potter Stewart once defined pornography, which is, I know it when I see it. That's where we are with this defining this region. But everything that leaves the sun goes through the middle corona, and there's also flow of energy and mass back down. A CME in the EUV, from AIA, we have observations going from hot lines, iron 21, down to cool lines, iron 9 and 10. And the visibility of a departing CME, you have the CME very visible in the 131 channel. Nothing at all is happening in the 171 angstrom EUV channel, which happens to be one that's one of the more common ones that's seen. There are other events that are just the opposite. You see them in the cool channel, not in the hot channel. The EUV with the temperature discrimination allows you a more comprehensive view of the departing event. As these events depart, they encounter the large-scale structure of the corona. We do have now some observations of the large-scale structure. SUVI is able to occasionally do off-pointed mosaics. So I want to focus in particular on one new technology. We've got the wide-field imaging is very well known. We are now able to implement slitless spectroscopy in the EUV. This is a grazed reflection grating, 5,000 lines per millimeter, and this allows us to build imaging spectrometers in the EUV and in the X-ray. One of these has flown on the MAGIX rocket, worked beautifully. What you get with this, you cover a huge temperature range, and you have density-sensitive lines, and the beautiful thing is that there are now methods to invert the spectrum, and so you can get temperature and density, full sun, all at once. And when there's a flare, you see the core of the flare in a large number of lines. You also see the expanding shock front, and you can measure the strength of the shock, see it interact with a large-scale structure, and possibly be able to predict SEP acceleration. We believe they will help improve forecasting. And of course, we hope to get a chance to do it. And there have been many papers written about this method, the technique, and why it matters. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
The Lunar Gateway is a space station that will be placed in orbit around the Moon. Primarily a manned station that will be occasionally occupied, Gateway will house instruments that will help monitor space weather events. One of those instruments will be Hermes, the Heliophysics Environmental and Radiation Measurement Experimental Suite. The project scientist for Hermes is Bill Patterson, who in February of 2022 described its science goals.
I'm Bill Patterson. I've been working for the past couple of years as a project scientist for this Hermes project. Hermes is an acronym, of course. It's the Heliophysics Environmental and Radiation Measurement Experiment Suite. Sort of a mouthful, not as contrived as some acronyms, happy to say. It actually makes a bit of sense. So I think it's a pretty good one. Hermes is a package of instrumentation, space weather instrumentation or heliophysics instrumentation that will be flying on the Gateway. And in fact, it launches with the first two Gateway modules. It's a heliophysics mission. Four in-situ instruments. These are meant to measure the charged particle environment, both at the low energies and at higher energies, and to tie those observations together and understand the interplanetary medium and the terrestrial magnetotail. Of course, we take a magnetometer along to measure the magnetic fields. Launch of the Gateway is now, we're expecting November 2024. Certainly not earlier than November 2024 is the Gateway line on this. And because we're traveling out to the Moon with a low thrust ion drive, it's actually going to take quite a while to spiral out there. It'll be about a 1 year transit to lunar orbit. And once we reach lunar orbit, we start a 2 year nominal science mission there. Actually, there's something quite fortunate about this, not under our control necessarily, but with 1 year transit and launch November 2024, we will arrive in lunar orbit probably shortly after solar max for solar cycle 25. And since we're interested in part in solar activity, this turns out to be quite useful. Science here leverages a couple of things. I should say the instrumentation is heritage instrumentation. This was a directed mission because the opportunity came up with not much time to get it together. So it was directed to Goddard. The instruments were chosen because of their high heritage. That actually turns out to be quite useful because, in fact, Gateway will be in this unique polar orbit, and having other heliophysics assets at other locations allows us to conduct some studies that will investigate things like structure. We'll be looking at some fundamental topics in heliophysics. There's a couple of things to be read between the lines in this bullet. One of these is that we are not necessarily directly conducting any kind of lunar science, although I'm certain that the measurements that we'll be providing are quite suitable for some investigations of the lunar surface and the lunar exosphere and the interaction with the exterior medium. And hopefully people will find a way to use the measurements to do that. The other thing is that this is, again, fundamental heliophysical science. We are not conducting operational space weather. Our connection to operational space weather, though, is that we see this as a pathfinder for future space exploration payloads. Our belief is that for lunar exploration, we have good assets at L1 to measure the in-situ environment approaching the Moon. But, you know, in the future, if there are missions with crew conducting deep space exploration, and they are well off the Sun-Earth line, it's probably going to be pretty prudent to take along some sort of space weather monitoring system, partly for the purpose of providing alerts, but maybe more importantly is that local measurements are going to be needed to help make predictions that are relevant and accurate. So for Hermes, the science objectives will be addressed by our instrument teams, but this is in collaboration with six external science teams. These are interdisciplinary science teams that were selected during the past year or so. And then the orbit of the Gateway itself, which is it's not a Keplerian orbit, it's a halo orbit, has a 7-day period, so it goes around the moon 4 times during one revolution of the moon about the Earth. It's pretty eccentric, a 3,000 kilometer periapsis over the north pole of the moon and 70,000 kilometers beneath the south pole. That, although there are other assets already in orbit at the moon, that's a unique feature that we make use of during this mission. Let me tell you a little bit about our science goals and objectives here. We have actually three separate goals, which we've designated A, B, and C. Goals A are related to the interplanetary medium, transport of mass and energy in the solar wind. Goal B, because we spend approximately 1 week out of 4 in the magnetotail, as does the moon, is to characterize energy topology and ion composition in the deep magnetotail. And so if you were to peruse these objectives over here, you would find that a lot of this has to do with examination of structures there. I'm going to come back to that in a minute. Our goal C is rather different. Although these are heritage instruments, science teams have a lot of experience with working with measurements from the particle spectrometers, the energetic particle telescope, the magnetometer. Typically, these instruments ride on spacecraft that were designed for the purpose. They're magnetically clean. They have frequently spinners to provide full of the sky for the particle instrumentation and other factors here. That is far from the case with Gateway. You know, Gateway is designed for exploration and for human habitation and as a docking port for other vehicles. And we expect that the observational conditions are going to be non-ideal. So with regard to future exploration, if this is going to be necessary to carry space weather stations in the future on vehicles with crew, this is a good opportunity for us to learn how to do this. And so we will be working with, for example, European colleagues and Moon to Mars office to develop this capability. And I think it's going to be a significant challenge just to fully understand the measurements. But I also think that these teams are going to get there. So I think I sort of mentioned already, to get scientific gain out of this mission, we really leverage three factors that are sort of equally weighted or dependent on one another. One is this polar lunar orbit. Takes us out of the equatorial plane. Second is that we have instrumentation in common with other heliophysics system observatory HSO missions. So this will allow us to compare measurements to investigate structure. For example, for larger scale structures, there's spacecraft at L1. For somewhat quite a bit smaller structures, we can compare with, for example, MMS. For fine structure, quite conveniently, we have a couple of Themis Artemis spacecraft in equatorial orbit at the moon. And then addition to this, Hermes adds some measurement capabilities to this constellation in cislunar space that really help complete the picture. So these are the four instruments. MERIT is our energetic particle telescope. NEMESIS wins award for best acronym. It's a magnetometer system, but it's three magnetometers because they believe they'll need to use gradiometry to try and subtract the interference fields coming from the Gateway itself. SPAN is a mass per charge ion analyzer, a mass spectrometer. That's a capability that we add here. Themis doesn't have that. So for unambiguous identification of, for example, atmospheric ions from the Earth, that will contribute. And EEA is an electron electrostatic analyzer. Goal C, establish observational capabilities for this package. So let me just tell you, these are some of the things we think are going to be challenges to the data analysis. And one is potential magnetism. magnetization of elements near the Hermes by the ion drive. The ion drive will not operate while we're in lunar orbit. Electric currents, of course, are going to affect the magnetometer. Spacecraft charging is going to be unusual. We already have some predictions of that. Limited coverage of the sky, similar to that. We have some obstructions that we have to deal with, and then charged particle scattering. So, although the Hermes objectives are heliophysics, we think that this can contribute quite a bit to studies of the moon. We'll see flux of terrestrial ions through the lunar surface, additional information on wake structure, lunar proton albedo is within our capabilities, and lunar pickup ions.
Bill Patterson, the Hermes Project scientist. As we now know, outer space is not entirely empty. It has tenuous plasma flowing through it. One of the early missions to study the solar wind was THEMIS, the Time, History, Events, and Macroscale Interactions During Substorms. This involved five satellites that were launched in 2007. Their principal aim was to study how space weather initiates the aurorae. Two of the THEMIS satellites were, in 2010, directed out of high Earth orbit and placed into lunar orbit. They were renamed Artemis, not to be confused with the current Artemis Humans to the Moon project. This original Artemis, ARTEMIS, stood for Acceleration, Reconnection, Turbulence, and Electrodynamics of the Moon's Interaction with the Sun. Well, these satellites are still operating well beyond their 2-year design life. Andrei Runov of the University of California, Los Angeles, is a member of the THEMIS Artemis science team. In February of 2022, he spoke on how these five spacecraft have been able to carry out multi-point investigations of the electromagnetic and plasma environment.
My goal today is to inform you about current status of the Artemis mission, which we'll just mention, and to share with you some ideas on how we can use Artemis measurements along with the Hermes suite and potentially lunar SOFRs assets to address some interesting and compelling science questions. So first, a little bit about Artemis mission. Well, in our genealogy, Artemis is the daughter of Themis. Themis was the five spacecraft mission to study essentially magnetic substorms in the magnetosphere, the Earth magnetosphere. And starting 2009, the two of outermost Themis probes were sent to the deep space. And finally, in 2011, were injected into stable lunar orbit with roughly 26 hours period and 100 kilometers to 19,000 kilometers altitude from the lunar surface. With the moon, the Artemis spacecraft spent most of the time in the solar wind and 3 to 4 days every month in the Earth magnetotail. Deep space network became available for us in 2013, and it allows us to downlink large percents of our data in the highest possible resolution. Due to mission bias, so to speak, we bias to the magnetotail, and we have 70% of the magnetotail data in highest resolution, and some interesting events like lunar wakes in the solar wind in highest resolution. But it's programmable and we can change it. In terms of data coveraging so far, we coverage almost entire solar cycle 24. Okay, a little bit about our measurements. The Artemis mission consists of two spin-stabilized equatorial orbiting probes equipped by Fluxgate magnetometer, which allows us to measure a magnetic field with resolution 4 to 120 vectors per second. Such coil magnetometer allows us to measure AC field up to 2 kilohertz Nyquist. Electric field instrument, we have 4 double probes in the equatorial, in the spin plane and spin axis plane. Also, we have the suite of particle instruments, which includes the electrostatic analyzer to measure ion and electron fluxes from first electron volts to tens of kilo electron volts. So Near Moon Environment is unique plasma laboratory in multi-point observations will allow us to study very interesting regime in plasma physics in weak, highly fluctuating magnetic field with strong gradients like current sheets, solar wind discontinuities, flux ropes, reconnection jet fronts, etc. With Lunar Gateway Hermes suite, we can do three-point measurements. Artemis probes are equatorial orbiting, while the Gateway will be polar orbiting. So that allows us to have three-point measurements with highly varying interspacecraft separation. Really interesting opportunity for us to study characterization of electromagnetic lunar environment and particle acceleration. Lunar Artemis and Hermes will provide information on electromagnetic and plasma conditions in near moon space. And what we will be interested, first of all, in this context is mapping to the lunar surface, which requires surface measurements.
James Spann is NASA's space weather lead. Before he speaks, I need to explain a few terms. CLPS, CLPS, is NASA's Commercial Lunar Payload Services Program, under which the space agency buys missions to deliver experiments to or around the moon. IRSA is the European Space Agency Radiation Sensor Array that, like Hermes, will be placed aboard the Gateway Space Station. And IDA is the Internal Dosimeter Array. James Spann is speaking to colleagues in May of 2022.
Okay, so on the agenda, I only have 5 minutes. And so just as a reminder, heliophysics is kind of an interesting division in the sense that it kind of captures a lot of aspects. And in fact, it's the one division that really touches all of the other science division in the sense that we study the sun, the extended atmosphere and its connectivity with the other solar system bodies, interstellar space, as well as our own planet. So just a couple of general highlights, and I'm not going to spend any time in this, but NASA is in the heliophysics in the process of selecting many new missions, as well as following the missions that we've got going on. A particular Parker Solar Probe, selecting several CubeSats, including DALI, as well as the new mission Hermes. We've announced a couple of new MEDEXs, all of which study the extended solar atmosphere, as well as the area in geospace. Certainly the sun missions are totally relevant to Artemis as we try to understand the environment in which the moon passes. The space weather program, we're establishing that, and that's, you can think of that as the applied part of heliophysics. And just so you know, we're planning for kind of a heliophysics big year, which really covers 2 years, and I guess that's why we call it big, because it's really two in one, as well as the increasing solar activity as we rise to the solar max of solar cycle 25. So we're going to have a lot of opportunities for the community to engage in this, both the science community as well as the public. The Artemis science objectives, at least for the Artemis 3, has been identified. I'll just point out that 4 of the 7 objectives are relevant to heliophysics. As we study the sun, use the surface of the moon as, or orbiting the moon as a unique opportunity to study heliophysics, as well as conducting fundamental plasma experiments. And the applied aspect is working to understand the space environment, exploration risks to human, and I would add robotic. As well, not only the Artemis program, but the CLIPS program, 9 of the 29 payloads that are expected to be delivered over the next year or so have relevance to heliophysics. What I really want to spend a little bit more time is talking about the science from Gateway that we can do. There is a long-term strategy that has been developed for this, and I wanted to describe a little bit about the first three payloads, the science payloads going on Gateway that are focused on the space environment, which is relevant to the surface science that can be done, but also the science that's enabled by having orbiting assets. And so the three payloads, this is an international activity. So Hermes is the NASA payload, URSA is the ESA payload. Those two are really focused on the radiation and solar wind energetic particles. And IDA is an internal dosimeter array, which is largely a partial copy of what is on the URSA payload, which is looking at radiation, both on the externally with the URSA payload and internally to the HALO with the IDA payload. I'll also mention that on the URSA payload, there is a low-velocity dust monitor that JAXA is providing. That's a late addition to really study the induced environment of the particulates and dust that will be generated by the activity on the Gateway and can serve as a baseline for future dust experiments that we would like to put on this platform. And so the Hermes goals and objectives are really enabled by the unique environment that the sun, that the moon provides as it orbits the Earth. About 75 to 80% of the time, it spends its time outside of the Earth's magnetosphere. And so looking at the transport and mechanisms of the solar wind, not only with this platform, but in conjunction with the existing orbiting platforms around the moon, particularly the Themis Artis platforms, provide a three-point measurement system over some scale sizes that are very unique and very useful to understanding the solar wind. The next goal is really focused on the time that the moon system spends in the Earth's deep magnetotail. And so in the same way as we do in the solar wind, studying the Earth's deep magnetotail in conjunction with other assets that are orbiting the Earth much closer, we can characterize the energy topology and ion composition of the deep magnetotail. And then the last goal is really focused on the applied aspect of Hermes, which is establishing a pathfinder for on-orbit observations of space weather that will help us look toward the future as we eventually end up in Mars with humans, and understanding what sort of observation capabilities are needed for Earth-independent space weather forecasting and mitigation capability. The Hermes payload comprised of four instruments, electron and ion top hat electrostatic analyzers. Then there's a MERIT ion and electron telescope. This is a solid state telescope looking at a little bit higher energy particles. And then a magnetometer.
Well, that's it. There is weather in space, not gusts of air and raindrops, rather gusts of electrically charged particles.